want to welcome you all to this very important meeting of our Committee of Justice and Constitutional Development. Today we'll be briefed by the department on the traditional court bill which is before us as a committee. And I want to take the opportunity to invite the department to proceed. Thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson. My name is Dion Rudman. I'm the Deputy Director General in the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, responsible for legislation. I would like to introduce my other colleagues that are with me here today to you. On my far left is Mr. Simon Gihani. He is the Deputy DG responsible for Policy and Court Services in the Department. To my right is J.B. Skosana, who heads the Policy Unit in the Department. On my left is Teresa Ross. She is in the Chief Directorate Legislative Development, responsible for the drafting of legislation, and she took responsibility for the drafting of this bill. And behind me, we have also two officials from the State Law Advisors, Ms. Soraya Williams and Ms. Pumalele Ngema. Chair, as you know, this bill was introduced into Parliament in 2008, and the then Portfolio Committee held public hearings on a number of occasions and debated the bill, but they did not finalize the bill. And the bill was, when this new Parliament started, was revived, and it is now before this committee. We have provided you, or we are in the process of providing you with documents. Firstly, it's a briefing document that contains a background to the bill and the content of the bill and where the bill stands at this very moment, what the previous portfolio committee did and what they recommended. And then there's also a policy document on the transformation of the traditional justice system. The bill that was introduced has also been provided to you, and also then a document containing the summary of submissions that were made to the previous portfolio committee during the public hearings. And then also a further document is a slide presentation on the contents of the bill. Chair, J.B., Skosana here on my right, will deal with the briefing document and give you information, as I have indicated, on the background to the bill, what the bill provides for, and I understand that at a later stage we will be looking at the clauses separately. But firstly, the briefing by Mr. J.B. Kosana.
Chair, before, I think with your permission, before J.B. starts, I just as the head of the unit to give my own input, I think that's the beginning of this process. I think the background that I would like to, articulate to this committee is just, to put us into proper perspective in terms of where we come from and where we are on this particular legislation and the policy that we discuss, I think, for these 2 days. After 1994, having rationalized most of the formal justice system, one of the areas that we have left, unattended, of course, for various reasons, was the whole issue around the mainstreaming of the traditional courts into the mainstream of our law. Safe to say that I wouldn't go much into history, but after 1994, we had about 10 different legal framework that regulates the operation of the traditional court system. We had to do a little bit of work just to firstly understand the dynamics and also to articulate what needs to be done to rationalize those laws, because we do know that this is but one area of our law that requires a full attention. As we know that prior to 1994, our indigenous law has always not been in the mainstream of our legal system. It has always been attended to as a side issue. Of course, with the adoption of our constitution, which was the first instrument that made our neediness law parallel to the Western, you know, legal system that currently we follow. We had not at that stage developed a uniform system that would regulate the conduction of the traditional, you know, disputes. As we know that, you know, the system of our indigenous law, which is but one of the systems that all of us, I think, especially those that believe in it, understand that this is a system that needs to be nurtured quite properly, because it's a system that has much grounding in terms of, you know, our ruralist people does believe in those kind of system. Now, I think after the adoption of the constitution, we then had to put up a process to look at what needs to be done to rationalize this. And I think the first process was the initiative by the South African Law Reform Commission. We did a lot of work just to look at what needs to be done to rationalize all of these, you know, 10 pieces of legislation and to come up with one uniform legislation that would regulate the traditional court system, but also to mainstream it in the main system of our law. And subsequent to that, then we as a department also, in addition to the initiative undertaken by the South African Law Reform Commission, we did a lot of work with the provinces. We involved most of the houses of the traditional leaders, both nationally as well as the provincial, just to look at what needs to be done to come up with the legislation that would sort of regulate entirely the indigenous law system. And hence, I think after that process, we then put up a proposal in terms of our policy, what are the issues that we have to look at in regulating this kind of system. I must say, Chair, it has not been a very easy system, because as I've indicated to you, that this is one legal system that has not been properly developed. And I know there are many challenges that are pointing in different directions about the loopholes in the system, but the point that we take as a department, imperfect as this law needs to be, but it's something that needs to be recognized as the constitution does, and we have to make sure that we perfect this law so that it's in conformity with the dictates of the constitution. And so this is but one piece of that legislation that seeks to regulate in the manner in which the traditional court system can be mainstreamed into our legal system. Chair, I also just need to put, I think, as a challenge here that we as a department also, in terms of our own jurisprudence, we also acknowledge that this is one system of our law which has not been properly developed and which will still require, I think, in terms of our own jurisprudence, a lot of attention for it to be improved. And so this is the first attempt, and I know that there may be some loopholes in it, but the idea that we take as a department is that we would like to promote this law, because we do believe that our legal system requires an informal formal recognition of our indigenous value system that also seeks to deal with the issues around the disputes. Because we do acknowledge that our formal legal system that we do have, though it doesn't address most of the challenges that we do face in terms of our crime patterns, we know that more particularly if one look at the social crimes or the social causes of crimes, we have not been able to deal with this particular problem. Hence, our courts are seized with such a very huge backlog of cases, precisely because the tendency has been to create that there's only one legal system that regulates disputes. And so our approach, and which will also inform what we call alternative dispute mechanism system, is to look at systems that we can empower communities in a small way to play a role in dispute resolution. And so in that context, we feel that I think that this challenge that we've taken in trying to regulate and recognize the traditional court system, it will be one of those areas where we put the responsibility in terms of issues of dealing with crimes and disputes, to back to our communities as well. And only those matters that are serious, on those matters that cannot be resolved through those kind of other methods, will then be left for this expensive formal Western system of our legal system that we would like to try and challenge. But I think what I would also indicate here that we had started with the traditional courts just to make sure that firstly we complied with the previous constitutional decision around this legislation that regulates the administration of black affairs. We do know that there's only two sections that have been left. The entire legislation has been declared unconstitutional, only two sections that were left, and which are those that try to regulate, the judicial system of our indigenous law. And so I think, Chair, our request is that I think once we have finalized this process of the traditional court, what would then also be left is what we also call the community court system, which is outside the rural, the areas of Amakhosi, which will also in there the department try to come up with a regulatory framework that will inform in terms of how do we get communities involved in dispute resolutions on matters that I think we would need to empower communities in a small way to participate on issues of the administration of justice. So, Chair, I think without much taking time, I think that's the background around the legislation, and I must say that, as Advocate Ratman has indicated, this legislation comes a long way, and I think there's a very huge expectation out there in the areas of Amakhosi in terms of progress on this legislation. And I would like to make sure that I think we do assist this committee to discharge its responsibility and duties to ensure that this legislation is finalized within the time frame that has been stated. So I'll ask Jamie just to take us through then with the substantive inputs of this policy, what it's all about here.
Thanks, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. And we welcome the opportunity to share with the committee the whole process relating to this bill. Chair, I also wanted to acknowledge that we are also accompanied by representatives from the National House of Traditional Leaders, Mr. Abraham Stott, and the Secretary of the National House, the Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs has mandated them to come and be part of this process. In drafting this bill, we have been basically working jointly with the National House and the Department concerned. Thanks, Chair. I've prepared some slides just to take the committee members through the process. There is a document we have circulated now. It provides a narrative version of what we are going to present here. We did try to send the documents through to Mr. Ramani, but I understand that the slide presentation did not come through. So we are making copies of the slide presentations, and they'll be brought in during the course of the presentation. But I'll just go through them quickly. As Advocate Jian and Advocate Ratman said, the whole bill was preceded by a policy process. The then minister, former minister, established a task team that was going to look at providing the basis for this legislation, looking at the issues that require policy articulation, doing the necessary research, doing the necessary consultation before the bill has been drafted, etc. And we have circulated the bill, Chair, which are, the principal will make cross-reference to that policy document here, etc. We needed the policy basically to facilitate the transformation of the system to be in line with the Constitution. We also wanted to give, through the policy process, the full recognition of the international justice system. We wanted to lay the basis for legislation for traditional courts as required by the Traditional Governance Framework Act of 1902-03. What had happened is that the Constitution in Chapter 12 requires national legislation to provide and regulate traditional affairs, and that legislation was subsequently developed by the then DPLG, and that is the Traditional Governance Framework Act. Section 20 of that Act requires of national departments to allocate functions to traditional leaders on matters that fall within the mandate of the department. With regard to justice, therefore, Section 20F of the Traditional Governance Act requires of the Minister of Justice to develop mechanisms to allocate to traditional leaders functions that relate to admission of justice. And therefore, this bill finds its basis from that kind of legislation. And obviously, to provide for the substitution of the Black Admission Act of 1929. As they have been said before, this was the the act, which was the bastion of the separate administration for Africans at the time. And when it was repealed in 2005, only those two provisions were retained, mainly to make sure that the system doesn't collapse. You retain them with a process that you transform and change them as you go ahead. As we sit here today, Chair, traditional courts are sitting. They are dealing with matters. They sit every day. They sit on Saturday. The only difference is that they are using the old act. They are using the Black Action Act today. So this act will be of 1929. And I will... There's a Black Administration Act of 1927, which provides a broader administration. Then there's one which relates to the courts. It's of 1929. Now, as we sit today and study, the courts are sitting. They don't have any proper guidance or guidelines. They use the whole system, etc., because of those two sections, which are not adequate enough to provide what's intended to be covered, etc. And therefore, we thought that this process would be quite the first step to assist the courts. The policy, the traditional courts also seeks to augment the current court system. And we'll try to show that. It's not an addition to the court system. It augments the court system in terms of dealing with matters which need to be diverted out of the court system, etc. It recognizes the different levels of conflict resolution, which starts at family level, it goes at community structures, headmen, at women level, and the traditional court. So it's a system which resolves disputes separately from a family, and once the matter is resolved in the family, it's end of the matter. If it does not resolve, then it goes to the local headman or headman who come and intervene. If it's not resolved, then it goes to this forum where the elders sit around and deal with the matters. And the other aspect is to standardize the whole court system across the Republic, creating uniformity and certainty. Different courts in different provinces, in different parts, sometimes even with a different within the same province, they employ different mechanisms, different standards. You go to a court in one rural village in KZN, you find that the sanctions being given, the process being followed, whatever, are different from the court used in another area within the same province, etc. Because they've got no guidelines that guide those courts, etc. So this act seeks to provide uniformity in terms of the approach, but also provide for peculiarity in terms of the different cultures and customs, etc. And obviously, we have had challenges. This policy process sought to address challenges which have been there. One of the challenges is a known challenge that there are areas which appear incompatible with the cultural values themselves, equality, cultural practices, etc. And now it's very important that we find a balance between the cultural practices themselves and what is allowed in terms of the Constitution. So those were issues which were identified when we dealt with this policy process. It also deals with the process of traditional courts as a judicial arm of government. Traditional courts in the past were defined as part of the judiciary. The traditional did not exercise judicial functions, etc. Now, if you look at the Constitution, there are two distinctions. One, they say whether traditional courts remain courts within the definition of Section 166, within the hierarchy of the court. Are we saying we've got traditional courts, magistrate courts, traditional courts, higher courts, etc.? Or are we saying traditional courts constitute alternative dispute resolution structures outside Chapter 8, but provide for in Section 34 of the Constitution, which allows for the establishment of tribunals and fora that could basically resolve disputes and use certain elements of the Constitution, impartiality, independence, etc. So this process sought to deal with those aspects, etc. And also look at the issue of lack of accountability. Lack of accountability in terms of current system, the abuse of powers by centralized leaders. It also look at the functions that may be meted out by this court. Now, after we've looked at those challenges, basically there are key policy thrusts which have been taken and which have been embedded into this bill. One basically is that the courts, in contrast with the current courts, mainstream courts, whose functions are to retributive, they are there to resolve problems once they have arisen. Traditional courts are there to promote social cohesion. They promote disputes before they arise. They don't only wait for aspects to happen, etc. That's the nature of the court. So it's a conflict resolution, but providing a base for harmony and stability and peace within the community, etc. And therefore, as we say, in terms of this bill, we see this court not as Section 166 court. Because if you put them as Section 166 court, the whole requirement relating to those courts becomes applicable. It means that they can detain, that the training officers must be appointed by the JSC and all these aspects, the training, the independence, whatever. That's not what is intended to the Section court. But it's intended to provide a mechanism outside the court system for conflict resolution. So you will see that the Treasurer Court will have certain powers, just like your CMA have got powers, just like your adult tribunals have got powers to deal with conflict resolution, not necessarily to deal with it in a manner of retribution, attorneys, legal representation, etc. That's how the bill seeks to deal with the issues. And we developed this from the definition that we have provided for in the Treasurer Court space. When we come to the bill, we'll indicate how we accepted this kind of policy thinking around also. It forms the three trial constitutions we have spoken to, the family, the community, and the traditional courts, etc. And also, we have taken into account the policy, the recommendations that derive from the Law Reform Commission. The Law Reform Commission has undertaken in 1995 extensive consultation the process and came with a document in 201 and 203, where they basically articulated and made some suggestions relating to this cause, etc. And we are dealing with those aspects of this document. There are certain aspects which have been taken forward in terms of this policy, and there are certain aspects which we do not see them, which do not seem to be compatible with the social justice system, and we reflect on those aspects as we move forward through the process, etc. Now, those are the key policy principles. And how they reflected on the bill. One, we have provided for a definition to avoid confusion and to provide clear clarity and certainty. Therefore, the courts are defined as a different form of court compared or in contrast to ordinary courts, etc. They are defined the way customary law defines it. They are in kunja makota kota, where you find a gathering of persons, elderly persons, who resolve disputes that have arisen within the community with a view to create peace and stability and to restore justice, restorative justice. That's what traditional courts are. And that definition seeks to articulate that kind of definition compared to how we define the magistrate court and the Supreme Court of Appeal and the High Court, etc. And to that extent, that's why the bill argued that because it gets that form of court, it therefore does not necessarily include legal representation. But it does provide for representation that is allowed and permissible under customary law. Under customary law, when you go to court, you are a child, you've got any form of vulnerability, you are allowed to be accompanied by your parents. The traditional leader of the community will come and say, where are the parents? So that they can deal with the matters in that. So those form of aspects are not excluded, but it's not legal representation in the way that is articulated in the ordinary court, etc. And it also addressed the conflict of law, systems applied in the local community that was your issue, which means you may find, because of the current situation, you find that within a traditional community, there are different people who subscribe to different traditions. But they happen to stay there because of the cross marriages, because of the different kinds of backgrounds, whatever. The bill tried to articulate if you happen that you've got two people who appear to be in the court, the other person subscribes to another cultural system, the other to another. How the court should deal with those aspects, etc. And obviously, what it says the general customary law applicable within the traditional community shall take preference over and above the other traditional customary law, which is not part of the system, etc. There was an issue around how do we designate traditional leaders to deal with this matters, etc. Designation by itself is a long concept. It was derived from the BAA Act. Traditional leaders, before in the current system, before they can deal with matters, they need to be designated by the Minister of Justice to make sure that they can exercise those judicial powers in various commas, etc. Now, in this bill, we retain those form of designation, but we retain for two purposes. One, to ensure accountability, and two, to ensure training process to reduce the abuses that are current within the system. So designation is brought in as a matter of checks and balances and accountability to make sure that traditional leaders are going to subscribe to the kosher values that are there, are going to make sure that they respect their human rights and the question relating to the way courts conduct themselves, etc. And you can only do that if there's some form of checks and balances or monitoring mechanisms that you can put in place. And designation is one of that method. No traditional leader will be able to, because traditional leaders are sent to the throne by death or by lineage, whatever. Now, to make sure that the traditional leader, once is there, fully empowered through the matters, there will be a necessity that there must be prior training, orientation, social contract training, human rights training, etc. And once those aspects have taken place, then that the minister can properly designate a person to deal with these matters, etc. We've tried to include within the bill also aspects relating to cultural values and respect for human rights. We have provided for the equal recognition and respect of the rights of women and children, etc. Something which does not exist in terms of the Black Lives Matter Act. In terms of the current system, women don't get the full protection or recognition in the traditional court. They don't get the full participation, etc. And for us to be able to do so, we've built in mechanisms in the Act to make sure that happens. We've also provided for the observance of the rules of national justice, which are basically applicable across all the tribunals, across all the courts, etc. And those are the rules that alone that one cannot be a judge in his own case. So if a traditional leader is affected by the matter at that end, there must be mechanisms for another person to come with the matter, etc. The rules that one must be entitled to be cross-examined, etc., are some of the rules of national justice which are there. Here the other side, are you asking for some rules? Here the other side, food said on the matter. All these rules have been embedded into the traditional court bill to make sure that people's rights are going to be respected by this court as they go in their daily process. I need to emphasize that not even a single of those principles apply in the current BAA Act as it stands. I've talked about the training. In terms of the planning, the training, all the traditional leaders and all the officers of this court will have to undergo training. And the period to serve in the bill is that 12 months after the commencement of the Act, they must all be trained. Otherwise, the minister would either revoke or not issue any designation as particular traditional leader, etc. We are providing for detailed regulation to provide the content of the training to make sure that the training responds to the challenges that are there at hand currently. The whole issue of the abuse of power, the whole issue of undermining the rights of women, the rights of children, etc. All those aspects will form part of this curriculum that will inform the training course that will be undertaken by the traditional leaders, etc. Although the Act allows exemption from undergoing the training, obviously the grounds of that exemption is, example, where the traditional leader of official concern have undergone a similar content training elsewhere, etc. But these are some of the safety valves or the checks and balances which the bill suggests to make sure that there's no abuse of powers that can be happened, etc. Jurisdiction is one of the most difficult issues, Honorable Chair, that we have to deal with during the policy process, etc. And there was a lot of debate to decide what can be included and what can be excluded, etc. There were debates around the aspect whether traditional courts can, in any event, hear criminal cases. Are they allowed to do criminal cases, etc.? And our argument is that to the extent that traditional courts are seen as an ADR mechanism, nothing prevents somebody who has stolen my watch to resolve that issue with the victim outside the court. Nothing prevents that today. Whether traditional courts are there or not, cases are withdrawn in court because people have made positive means to address matters which are before them. Now, by putting this in the bill, we are basically encouraging the current status. The current status allow conflict resolution other than the litigious process. The prosecutor cannot rule otherwise. If the complainant says, I was assaulted commonly and the person have shown remorse, they have taken me to hospital, etc. There are certain matters where ADR cannot take place, even within the formal court system, etc. And this is taken care of. The matters that this court can deal with are matters which ordinarily, even at the normal criminal courts, will be basically diverted to issues of ADR or restorative justice. Now, we provide a mechanism to facilitate those problems to happen so that petty crime, petty offenses, criminal injury, insulting, animal strain, whatever, can be resolved outside the formal court system by the social leaders. And this will allow basically the process to take place. So there's nothing untoward in providing criminal justice in this court to happen because they deal with those aspects, etc. And we've also said that one of the jurisdictions that must be used by the court is that they must deal with matters which have arisen within the area of jurisdiction of the traditional communities where they reside, etc. We've got a schedule to the Act which will basically list the necessary offences in respect of which traditional courts will exercise jurisdiction as part of their constitutional mechanisms, etc. And we trust that this list of offences will be updated from time to time as time goes on, etc. But as I said, it takes care of petty offences, petty theft, malicious domestic property of a less serious nature, assault common, stray animals, and civil disputes relating to money as well, where people owe each other 50, 100, 100, etc. They happen every day. They deal with those matters every day. And we do not want people not to have access to a civil justice system simply because there's no mechanism in place to assist them. The small claims court deal with offenses of 7,000 and less, because if you're going to get an attorney to go and get your 5,000, etc., you're going to pay 10 times what you are owed, etc. Now, this court will deal with those matters at the local community, which doesn't even need to go to court, don't need legal involvement of legal practitioners, don't need them for you to issue processes to go to the massive court, etc. Currently, the court says you can issue civil processes for any matter of 200 rands or less. That's what the law says. The slack of the court can chase you away if I owe you 150 rands. But now, if you are chased away, where do you go to? So these are the structures that are going to provide the gap in terms of helping people to find social justice at the end of the day. Compensatory matters was also one of the issues which were debated at last during the policy development process. The emphasis has always been on the fact that the court sanctions should be compensatory and should be restorative rather than punitive, etc. We must be aware, as I said, before 1994, traditional courts exercised judicial functions. Courts in the old Transkei could send people to jail, instead elsewhere. All that was required was that once a traditional leader has sentenced to 3 months, you must take that sentence to a magistrate to endorse it. That's all that was required. The magistrate did not have to call parties. The magistrate just to put a signature so that the police should then take you to jail. That's what happened in the past, etc. Now, all those sentences are not part of this system because those are retributive. The formal courts will deal with imprisonment, will deal with issues of legal representation, issues of 48 hour detention, whatever. In the past, traditional courts could send traditional police to go and arrest you. The hours were not applicable, could be kept at the cells, built next to the chief's court, where you, without any hours, etc. Blah, blah. All those aspects are now dealt away with. Traditional courts can only call people, cannot impose imprisonment, will only order community service functions, and those are restorative. If it's malicious damage to property, you must repair. My window broken. If you have not broken my window, but you have insulted somebody else, you must be able to be subject to go and clean the school, the public schools. You must go and be subject and clean and dug the grave cemetery. And that's what's happening currently in terms of that aspect. The only difference is that we don't have a framework for that to happen. And this bill provides a kind of framework. All those unconstitutional methods of punishment, like banishment, whatever, chasing away from the area, have been ignored from the bill. They are not part of the bill. You can only allow these functions that promote social harmony. I said, Chair, that one of the most important aspects of this court is firstly the diversion of cases where it's necessary. Most of the cases that go to the ordinary courts are not supposed to go there. But they go there simply because people don't have another court. That's why when courts come to present, they'll tell you that out of 1.2 million cases reported every year, 390,000 are withdrawn. Well, there are those who are withdrawn because there are no police dockets, there are also all some challenges. some of the metaphysical drone is simply because they are either wrong for us. There are no mechanisms to assist the people to resolve that dispute outside the formal court system. So this system provides for the first time diversion. If a prosecutor on receipt of a matter is of the opinion that this matter can be dealt better outside the ordinary court, the prosecutor can divert the matter directly to the national court to promote social cohesion. If a magistrate has listened to a matter, and when the matter goes on and on and on, is realized that this matter can be dealt with outside this court, the magistrate can divert the matter to the national court. Similarly, if the national court has started a matter, which initially appeared to be a common assault matter, it later came out to be this is a serious matter, it must be dealt with by the formal court, it needs imprisonment. The traditional leader must divert the matter to the formal court so that the formal court can continue with it. So it provides a cross-transfer mechanism which was never there in the past, etc. So to that extent, we hope it's going to provide a relief to the current system that applies in the judicial system. There was another aspect of the appeal which was dealt with extensively. And the report, the recommendation of the Law Reform Commission recommends, for example, that we consider the possibility of creating appeal court structures around for the traditional courts, etc. And we argue from the police perspective that since these courts are there to promote peace and to conserve community, it's not necessary to subject them to appeal. Because if those people cannot be conserved, if peace cannot be maintained, because of the technicality, because it requires different approach, then the matter can be sent to a normal court, etc. We should not be providing a mechanism at the same time, subject to the appeal system, etc. This system applies in Botswana, simply because in Botswana, they've got a formal traditional court system. The courts in Botswana are part of the formal court system. They've got a customary court appeal court, which is turned over by a judge and traditional judges in the process, whatever, etc. That's a complex process. This one is intended to provide and facilitate those mechanisms. Therefore, we our view is that the appeal should not be there. But obviously, in terms of the Constitution, PAYA and PAJA are applicable in terms of the review. If decisions are taken and those decisions are against the processes or procedures prescribed, the litigants can take the matter to the medical court for review. And the process may be set aside and be set afresh, etc. Those still apply as part of the normal rules of justice. We have also said that where the sentence is out of bounds, where the training of the sentence as per the channel for foreign law, the person can go to court to appeal against the process and the procedure, the arbitrary nature of the process, not against, you can't appeal against an apology. If you must apologize to your community for the wrong done, you must apologize, you cannot apologize and tomorrow go and lay an appeal, because you don't have a system of previous records of whatever, etc. But obviously there are mechanisms. If somebody is a repeat offender at a traditional court, the traditional leader can still take them to a formal court for them to be dealt with in a more harsh way than the traditional court system. So there are those kinds of mechanisms which have been built to make sure that there's support system to this kind of structure, etc. One of the issues which were raised during the policy development process was whether must we build courts next to the magistrate court to be traditional courts. And I think it's one aspect that we dealt with the department, the department of DPLG, which is responsible for providing support to the traditional leaders and the House of Traditional Leaders. Our view is that the traditional justice system is a system. It's not infrastructure based. If there are disputes, you take the parties to their family head at home. No, we don't need to get a different family room at home to resolve disputes. That's why in terms of practice and culture, disputes were resolved, the issue whether they are buildings was never an issue. On Saturdays, the community elders gather under a tree and deal with the matter. They now gather in classrooms, school classrooms, and they never look at fancy buildings, whatever, with all these medicine benches, whatever, because it is not in compatible with the social justice system. It's intended to resolve the issues, etc. Now, we say to the extent that the traditional authorities, the traditional leaders currently, are provided offices and infrastructure by the Department of Corporate Governance and Traditional Affairs. They are provided with resources to provide, to make sure that their day-to-day functions are being taken within a conducive environment. They've got offices, they've got secretaries, they've got cars, they've got computers, they've got everything there. You don't need to create separate courts next to those buildings for hearing of traditional matters. That's not typical of customary law. And that's not typical of resolving disputes. That's customary of conventional law that we have, courts that we have today, because the next thing you are going to require is to build a prison for traditional courts, etc. Hence we say that to the extent that those infrastructures that are typical of the conventional courts are not applicable under customary law. It's a system that allows the social leaders to operate and to deal with matters within their available infrastructure environment. But we do take note that traditional leaders and traditional councils must be accommodated within proper infrastructure, but not courts. And that is what government provides at local and provincial level, etc. From the department side, obviously, we take the need and the acceptance that there are functions that are just that technical in nature, related to this court, that need to be provided for by special trained clerks of the court, etc. Clerks of the traditional court, whatever. To that extent, the department in the process committed said that it will provide that assistance. It will go to this court and say, to the extent that there's no assistance for clerical work related to this matter, for the implementation of this act, the department will provide this kind of resource, etc. And that function will include service of notices for those courts, record keeping, correspondence in relation to referrals, and monitoring the system's referral of matters for reviews, etc. Those are matters that require special training of clerks, and the department will provide that kind of training to make sure that the system does not basically collapse because of those challenges. Just to indicate briefly that when the bill was during the public hearings here, there were quite a number of concerns which were raised. And I want to emphasize that those concerns most of those concerns that the bill seeks to address them. Those concerns are attributable to the system, not the bill itself. The whole issue of abuse of power is an issue that the bill must seek to deal with, and it's an issue that it requires monitoring mechanisms, etc. But you cannot basically deal with abuse of power by abolishing those courts in any event, etc. But what then happened is that there was an arrangement that perhaps to deal with those concerns, some of the concerns raised during the hearing, will then be a federal consultation process at provincial level, so that they could basically get the views, Parliament can get the views from the communities to get first-hand information, etc. And we also understand that those public hearings may be preceded by public awareness campaigns to make sure that communities are basically able to respond and participate constructively during the public participation process. There are things which the department is currently working on related to the bill. And one is the matter of capacity for those courts, as I've indicated, that we need to provide a support in terms of the administrative support structure, in terms of training, in terms of designation. All those matters that require the minister's intervention will have to be brought forward in terms of the regulations. Regulations have been drafted, and I think we have established a task team jointly with the Department of Cooperative Governance and Social Affairs to make sure that those regulations are finalized, etc. And there will be consultation processes once the draft has been finalized or so. There's also a process that looking at the content of the training course that should be developed, and Justice College has been requested to assist in the process, and obviously other structures within the civil society, within the legal fraternity will basically be asked to assist in developing a program and also implementing the program, etc. It's our view that regulations should be published simultaneously with the enactment of the bill, so that there's no gap in between. There's enough infrastructure on the ground to implement the act and to achieve the objective of the act. And we anticipate that should everything go according to plan in terms of the budget deadline, the department should be able to commence the training program, implementation thereof, from April 2010, because it's also one of the aspects which is linked to the budget processes, etc. And we thought that the designation of such leaders would then be informed but the training program, etc. Chair, this is basically the basic principles that informed the bill. As Advocate Gianni said, it may not be a perfect bill, but Chair, it cannot be worse than the Black Administration Act. The Black Administration Act is couched in an extensive dehumanizing manner. The act which currently applies, it's very exclusive in terms of jurisdiction, and does not provide any guidelines to social courts. That's why they provide different sanctions. They take different approaches. They abuse people in work courts, etc. We cannot rule out those aspects, but attempts in this bill have been made to address those aspects. If we stop this bill, it means then the BAA must continue. It has continued since 1929 till today, still operational. The only aspects of the BAA which cannot be implemented are those of imprisonment and those of corporal punishment. But we also do get some complaints that at some places corporal punishment still do take place because we don't have any monitoring mechanisms in terms of which all these aspects are monitored. So what we are saying, Chair, is that attempts have been made in the Federal Court Bill to address most of the challenges that have been raised during the policy run process, and we hope that with the assistance of this committee, we should be able to refine the bill in a manner that allows a better system than the current system that we have in place. Thank you, Chair. And I don't know if there will be contribution to my colleague here, Ms. Ross.
Thank you very much. Any additions?
Thanks, Edna.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, there we are, presentation. We are now at questions and answers. Committee members, honorable Dean, please.
Thank you, Chair. And to Mr. Scusano, advocate, I found that really interesting. Thank you. But now, may I ask something? Before we now embark on the consultation, which indeed must occur, an enormous amount of consultation occurred from the transition onwards, is that not right, under the aegis of the Law Commission? And it seems to me a pity that that is all lost, in a sense that consultation has already been done. And I would just like to understand in as crisp a way as possible why this bill has departed so fundamentally, as I understand it, because let me rush to say that I haven't read your bill. I have read all the surrounding material, but the JAC ruling ruined my weekend for me in respect of reading. Why does this depart so radically from the draft bill from the Law Commission, which was fully consulted? Perhaps you could just give us a very crisp summary of how that differs, because I see from the comment that was taken in 2008 by this committee that many, many NGOs and other bodies complain of that fact. They say there has not been consultation on this bill, that it does not take the submission into consideration made to the Law Commission, that the nuanced and balanced proposals of the Law Commission have been lost in this bill. And so please, if you could just, A, give me a crisp summary of the difference between the two and why that happened. And the last question, does your bill still exclude from the jurisdiction of the customary courts matters like the interpretation of wills, the dissolution of marriages, the determination of custody and guardianship of minors, and maintenance? And these are particularly, of course, issues which have an effect on women. And the big challenge when we come to customary law is Section 9 of the Constitution and giving true effect to the equality of women. That's the real challenge, to add that to the many absolutely wonderful features of the existing customary regime. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Advocate Kosana, I must say that the briefing, it is inspiring to an extent that one gets the hope that the BAA Act of 1929 will not be extended further, that with these maybe there will be some consensus that the traditional courts bill be moved forward with. I just want to find out, you spoke about jurisdiction, but you only referred to jurisdiction in terms of the nature of the matters that would be brought before the traditional court. I want to find out, insofar as the area is concerned, what does the bill provide insofar as the area is concerned? Maybe also to say, insofar as the person is concerned, can a person object and say, I don't want to appear before that traditional court because the headman or the headwoman is a Zulu. I belong to the Nguni group, therefore I think that court does not have jurisdiction over me. And then, yeah, that those two issues.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a couple of practical questions that maybe I missed and but I just would like clarity on it. The ministerial designation for kings, queens, and senior traditional leaders. What if these people haven't undergone training? Because later we hear that under training, it says that regulations will prescribe training courses. However, traditional leaders may be exempted from undergoing such training. So, you know, then we come back to the problem of how do you regulate how these cases are heard and what kind of sanctions are delivered if certain members are exempted from not participating in training. I think that could cause problems that we are trying to come around. And then another problem that I have lies with the Section 13 of appeals. It says appeals lie where orders are not in keeping with the need to promote restorative justice. But, you know, you could have a case where I've smashed your window and the person that comes in after me has also smashed the window and he gets told to clean a school and I get told to clean municipal buses for 4 weeks. So we don't have the same kind of sanction and I should have leave to appeal to find out why the sentences weren't the same. So, I understand what you mean by restorative justice, but, you know, where penalties aren't given in the same fashion for the same crime, people must also have the leave to appeal. That's a fundamental cornerstone of natural justice.
No, I mean,
more questions or comments? Is it another round or do we have only this round?
No.
Because I'd like to hear. I'd like to come later. If that's okay.
I don't know. There was this. That's as to answer the questions. Maybe also to clarify the reasons why the bill was referred back, if it was at all. Was it press of time? Was it the concerns? I think there were concerns, and they've been addressed in the new draft. If there is a new draft, I'm saying if because I'm new here. There are all members. Who have an idea what has happened, and the department as well would know. Yeah.
Chair, I've got another question, and this is just practically as a white woman that lives in a predominantly white suburb. What kind of education and promotion will this bill take to areas where, for example, in rural KwaZulu-Natal, where you have white farmers together with Zulu farmers, together with Indian farmers, so that everyone understands that you're on an equal playing field with regards to this bill and that it doesn't necessarily, you know, exclude any South African on the basis of race or ethnicity. How are we going to overcome that? Because that's a boundary that's going to definitely come up.
Thanks, Chair, and thanks, Honourable Members. there were extensive consultations by the Law Reform Commission.
the Law Reform Commission initially issued a discussion document which was circulated with comments, and there were comments, parliament commented, community commented, and there were meetings and workshops, and there were even challenges at those workshops and some other area committees that want to submit in the presence of such leaders, etc. And there were many views expressed, and they submitted a report with a draft bill to the department. In that report, they also made observations that there are key policy issues they did not want to give reflection on. And as one understand the role of the Law Reform Commission is to advise government, but they also indicated that there are other areas where we would leave it to government to be defined by policy. There would not be, but they gave the experience of what they got from the ground. They raised many issues. Now, let me show you, let me give the example of the different aspects. In the policy, when you look at the policy development, Law Reform Commission was involved with law reform. They were in the process of reforming a legislation that was there in 1929. And after MEPS comments to us, we had to embark on a policy process to review what they said in terms of law reform and what should be dealt by policy. So the task team that was approved by the minister, which comprised ourselves and DPLG, etc., looked into the report and went to the detail of the report, etc., and summarized areas of contentions, whatever, etc. For example, the legislation, they provided legislation provides for representation or participation of women in the customary court, which have been taken forward in terms of this bill. Basically, to address the stereotypes and the undermining of women participation, etc. Those were the aspects that we have raised. Two, legal representation should not be permissible in presence before customary court, which are issues taken forward in terms of the recommendations. Three, customary court should be empowered to impose fines and suspended sentences. We do not agree with suspended sentences because only a judicial officer, a suspended sentence. It's like an imprisonment. Only to serve it at home, etc. Now, for you to impose a suspended sentence, the due processes prescribed in the Criminal Procedure Act must take precedence. There must be legal representation. You cannot say one, there must not be legal representation, but you must say, you can give me first a suspended sentence, etc. So we don't agree with that from a policy perspective. For defendants in prison before criminal court should have the right to opt out and take the matter to the other mainstream court. Now, when during the public hearings, there was a lot of debate in this matter, and which I can still emphasize today. I'm saying, you need not write in law, in black and white, that you can opt out. It is an I even gave an example in this committee. I said, the bill seeks to provide a mechanism to assist dispute resolution, but cannot provide and say, people with disputes of this nature, whatever, come, will help you. Then thereafter, we also write below that, but after you come, you can go back. You can't do that. We understand that there are areas where there will always be contention as a party, etc. And we understand those aspects should be dealt with in terms of the precedent which attends there currently. We don't want to list it on them. Open out happens in two areas. One, whether a defendant who has been reported to federal court can basically say to I can't go to court. If those two parties together agree that they resolve the matter outside this court to the other court, there's no problem. The court can endorse the resolution. But if the people are staying within the area and one of them goes to the court and the other one is giving a notice, customary cannot say no. In terms of customary law, you cannot say no when the chief, the federal judge calls you. You cannot say no customary. Now, this bill does not change customary law. That's why even so they say there's an underlying respect for the weight of the key. It is there. Now, you cannot go there and when the key says I want to reconcile, say, no, I can't be assisted by this court. I don't take your weight forward, etc. So it's built from this aspect. But we do understand that there will basically be very serious processes in consequences because it subscribes people to this court. that this law must be read, Mr. Swain, must be read with the Traditional Affairs Traditional Governance Framework Act. Firstly, a premier recognizes a traditional community who live according to customary law in a particular area. Before a court comes into play, and these things were not there in the past. So you will never find a traditional court where there's not one traditional leader recognized and a traditional community recognized which lives according to customary law. So those are the requirements that allows cognition, etc. Now, usually those people who reside there, they are living under customary law in terms of those areas, etc. And a person who lives and follow a customary law system will not follow it only in part of one aspect. I cannot choose to take my kids to initial school with my traditional community, but when the very same king called me to come and resolve disputes, I said I'm in Zulu. If I stay there, I subscribe to customary law and practice of this particular community. By that affiliation, I'm surrounding myself to the rules of this community. And this matter, we must look at within the context of the development of society. If you stay in Silver Lakes and it's an estate and there are rules that apply there, etc., and those rules, you circle the rules by virtue of being in that particular place. Not that they're unconstitutional. You say you want to live in an estate, they tell you there that here there's no fire, there's no burning of rubbish after 5 o'clock. You can't bring 10 visitors, etc. These are the rules of the community. Firstly, there's a community. Two, the community subscribes to customary law practices. And three, this act recognizes that a trust of the community will then apply customary law in a particular way, etc. So all those things are interrelated, similar to its own jurisdiction. We do not want to define jurisdiction outside the traditional governance framework act, because the premier defines the community and the threats where the traditional councils operate, etc. And the court will follow that jurisdiction. You may find that, for example, within one metal district, Mzimkulu, you may find that there are three traditional communities recognized by the bill, which means for purpose of appeals, whatever, those three traditional communities, or five, will then be subject to one magisterial district. So you don't define a court in terms of area outside the boundary of the area where the traditional leader and where the traditional council has got jurisdiction in terms of the governance framework, etc. So this act based on this kind of prior systems which have been put in place, etc. And I want to say opting out is a very difficult concept, etc. We do not want to provide for it here, etc. But traditional leaders, when you consult with them, etc., they also felt that this one area which will basically, to them, if there's an opting out in this bill, then it's as good as not providing for any mechanism, because everybody can just come and say, although I'm staying here, although I'm part of the traditional community, although I'm partying, I'll never pay the levies that are imposed by the traditional council. Although the traditional government framework provides for a system of customary law that must take place in this kind of community, etc. So these courts are part of the mechanism of enforcement of the traditional customs and values. And what it does, it provides a framework, the constitutional framework within which that must happen, etc. One thing was raised, Mr. Swain, is that there may be is the issue of conflict of laws. One, you may not be willing to stay in Kazangezwa, traditional community. You go there, you apply for a land, you go to traditional community leader, they ask you for a cow, you pay the cow, they ask for all the Jews of the traditional leaders, you register your kids, you take your kids to the initial school there, Kazangezwa. But tomorrow you say you're a Zulu. That does not, is not compatible with your affiliation. The moment you affiliate your rules and practices of the particular community, you go there by choice, by the way. Nobody takes you there. I belong to Mtuchane Siyabuswa, KwaMabhoko Traditional Authority there, etc. I go there by choice. If you don't have to go there, you don't have to go there. But you cannot get land there, participate in the local affairs there, and tomorrow raise an objection that no. To the extent that you deal with conflict resolution, I'm not part of you. But tomorrow I'll come and pay the dues. There are many dues that happen, customary law, etc. That happens, which are allowed, etc. And you cannot disown them. When I've got a burial, I cannot refuse to go and dug a hole for my neighbor. All elders come, go on Sunday morning, get the peace. They are going to perform their communal duty. And you perform them because you subscribe to them. If you stay in Silver Lakes, they don't do them. They hire municipal to come and do it. You cannot go there and teach. So you subscribe to the principles applied in particular land, etc. And you cannot disown it at your own leisure. That's the principle of the business. That's why we don't want to write in black and white. But the parties themselves may come to an agreement that, look, this matter must be dealt by the Magic Court. The Magic Court won't send you out, away, etc. I think I've covered most of the aspects. The appeal. The regulations, we thought that Tashan Colonel was a small president. So, because there's no small president, because they were never recorded in the past, it does happen that somebody steals a sheep, a chicken, he cleans the president and the court. Another one is fined 2,000 rand, etc. There are inconsistencies. And we hope that with a system of records and with a system of regulation, there will be some guidelines. I said earlier on, there are no guidelines that inform traditional leaders. So the training that we're going to take is going also to develop that kind of students for the traditional course so that they can deal with particular way in a way that they are preemptive and that there's uniformity across the system, etc. It's a challenge, but you must start somewhere. The BAA, just to show you how out of order it is, it still stipulates that a fine, not exceeding 10 rand. But nobody uses that word. All I know that there are people fined 2,000 rand, etc. And when you ask the leader, they argue that inflation has gone 2,000 times. So we are still finding 10 rand, which was then 1929, but today it's equal to 2,000 rand, etc. And those are things that this law will seek to regulate and provide some form of precedence over them also. At least there will be a stipulated fine for this office, unlike now when there's nothing in place and nobody wants to follow the 10 rands, which is in the BA Act, regulations of the BA Act, etc. The bill was never respected by the department, Chair. The bill is still with the committee. The idea was that once there's been some form of discussion, consensus around these issues, it will assist the committee to move forward with the bill. And I want to stress that since the public hearings, we have continued to engage outside Parliament because our interest is to get to a resolution of this matter. We have continued to engage the Human Rights Commission. We have continued to engage the COSATU. The initial objection was that by providing for community sanctions, it may create some abuse of the system in the form of some form of forced labor. Not permissible in terms of the Labor Relations Act, etc. And we've engaged with COSATU and said we need to provide mechanisms and legislation to make sure that does not happen. That's not the intention of the Act. The intention of the Act is the reconciliation and restorative, etc. To the extent that that here that may lead to unintended consequences that must be well recasted in the Act, etc. So there was a view in thinking that there will be, once the public hearings have taken place, etc., some of the clauses they may need to be looked at in a way that articulates the intention clearer than this current the situation, etc. Training, the exemption, I try to explain. The exemption regulations will develop circumstances, grounds for exemption. It's not an open ground for exemption. That's why I say it might be so that some of the traditional leaders have undergone social context training. I've got one traditional leader in Limpopo who's both a magistrate and a traditional leader, etc. And I don't think that it will be putting the resources of the state to proper use if I call that person to undergo basic human rights training, etc. While the person has undergone 10 times training at Justice College on the same subject, etc. So those are part of the examples for exemption. It's not a blanket exemption and will be provided for in regulation, etc., which will be drafted to make sure that all the traditional leaders undergo the training. How the Act is crafted is that if you don't undergo the training within 12 months, the business will be revoked, which means the license to deal with the matter will be withdrawn by from the traditional leaders until the first time that the traditional leaders have undergone the necessary training. So that's the intention of the legislation, etc. Thank you.
Chair, and just, I think I've just found the answer to this, an outstanding question. I was reading from the Law Commission report, which excluded the jurisdiction over wills, maintenance, children, but I think I've just found it. That's what in, it's clause 5.
Yes.
Is that correct? And it is still excluded. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. I think the maybe just background issues. The previous committee adopted a report, which I think was distributed to us. It's quite short, and it did identify what it felt was the key issues of in contention. One of them is the opting out issue. But I think that what would be useful, I mean, a lot of work was done by the Law Commission. I think we were given the report. The previous committee did have Professor Nsapo, who was head of that project for the commission, to come and speak to it. It would be useful to, I think, look at the differences between, I know Mr. Skosana has tried a explanation as to why the department changed things, but I think it would be useful to sort of see those differences and to have a formal written response from the department about why those changes were made, and maybe even to hear from the commission from Professor Nsapo. Chair, sorry, I one of my colleagues has sort of could I request through you that Ms. Smuts doesn't comment. I don't know if you can. Sorry, Dean, but
no, it's but difficult. You are a very good partnership.
thank you, Chair. That's a kiss of whatever. but I think it would be useful to set that out. I see that we've been given a document from the Parliamentary Research Unit, which does that to some extent. It's dated 25th of August. I was only able to read it now. But I think that would be useful. The other question that I would be interested in is how does the bill change the existing law or practice? So if we pass this bill as is, once it's signed into effect, it comes into effect, what will change on the ground? I would be interested in the answer to that question, and I think that's a question that the department would need to prepare on. What changes are we making? So really, in short, what I'm saying is I think we need to look quite seriously at the differences between this bill and the Law Commission draft and examine why, okay, both from the department side and the Law Commission side. Two, how are we changing the existing law? And then I think we've got to get to grips with the process point. I mean, the previous committee's report was there were lots of complaints in the hearings about the public consultation process. The previous committee's report was a joint hearings in the provinces with the NCOP. Obviously, the NCOP needs to have hearings. Do we do it jointly? I don't think the NA on its own should go to the provinces. Do we simply take, because the bill was revived, there's also a document of a summary of the submissions that were made. Do we take those and consider that as adequate and then look at the bill when it comes back from the NCOP, those kinds of process-related questions. But maybe just on the opting out thing, and I didn't really want to engage with specific points. Mr. Skosana, but maybe seeing I'm on the floor, Mr. Skosana sort of refers to the process as being ADR, alternative dispute resolution. My understanding is mostly in ADR, it's consensual. You consent to ADR. I'm not sure if there are any other cases of compulsory ADR. And isn't there a sort of contradiction that you in a sense have a – most of what's here is based on voluntary submission. It's a bit like, I think, the small claims court. You don't have right of legal representation in the small claims court. You don't have right of appeal in the small claims court. But it's fine because you voluntarily agree to it. Now, if one is saying no legal representation in traditional courts, which I think is correct, because if you bring in, with respect to those of us here that have legal training, if you bring them in,
us in whatever, it will defeat the object because things can get hell of a complicated. And similarly, I'm very sympathetic on the issue of not having appeals, because if you have a system of customary law and yet then you have an appeal to a magistrate's court, and you may end up with a magistrate who has no idea of how the customs of that area work, and you're then saying in a sense the traditional court is below the magistrate's court, which I don't think is the intention. But my problem is that if you take away those two rights, but you don't have you have enforced ADR. There's a contradiction. I think it's a longer debate. It's as has been said, at the nub of one of the crucial problems. But maybe just for now, then the question to Mr. Kosana would be: is there any other alternative dispute resolution processes which are compulsory?
I will start, and my colleagues will augment. Quite. Oh, I see the honourable member is out. And, yes. Okay. I know he has asked some of his questions in the past. We will look into the distinction. And we'll provide a detailed report between the Law Reform Commission bill and this bill, etc. And basically provide the basis for departure. But I would like to emphasize that in most respects, the sentiments raised in this bill has been taken forward in the current bill, etc. To the extent that there's a need to enhance and promote the new value system, and there's a need to recognize the equal participation, equal rights, all those aspects. And we've even gone beyond. We're providing this bill more than what the Law Reform Commission thought, because we're going to provide a mechanism to ensure the checks and balance, whatever, etc. But we can look at those differences and submit to the committee those aspects. There will be quite substantive changes, but the changes, as I emphasized before, this law does not change customary law. Customary law is a law of its own, which is recognized as part of our system. And the Constitution enjoins the traditional leaders, the ordinary courts, judges and magistrates, tribunals, forums, to develop customary law. So the Constitution recognizes that customary law is part of our system, but customary law may not be in keeping with the constitutional values as we are currently. And there is a court judgment. There have been many efforts to do that. The whole change to the whole aspect of inheritance on the basis of women by the court. The whole issue of the challenge to brought the Constitutional Court by an honorable member of parliament in terms of ascension to the throne, etc. Those are part of the development of the system that will keep happening on the ground, etc. But we cannot change customary law simply by piece of legislation like this. So this law does not change customary law at all. It only regulates the procedure to be in line with the Constitution, constitutional imperative. It enhances the observance of constitutional values. It obliges the traditional courts to take into account, to respect and to operate under the Constitution. That's what it does. It deals with the procedure as predecessor. All the other substantive law changes will happen as a normal course of the development of the system, etc. For example, the whole issue of, Mr. Siwanyelo will know, the whole issue of forced attendance of initiation school, etc. All those aspects are aspects that can be dealt with in terms of constitution, not in terms of what customary law used to say in the past. In the past, it used to be obligatory, etc. Now, this law does not say that must happen. All it provided to extend that something happens, it must happen in a manner and procedure that is consistent with the Constitution. So that's the emphasis we want to do. Therefore, changes to the law will change the current customary law in the sense that, one, it will then for the first time give them a roadmap guidelines and rules they must follow in dealing with the matter, which currently may be there, may not be observed, they may be undermined, they may do everything, etc. But it gives them that obligation to do, such as that, also the cause, etc. That's the first thing. And second thing, not only to prescribe, it also provides a compulsory training program, empowerment, so that they should be able to do their work better. So we're building efficiency and legitimacy through this act, which are not there. We're building accountability, which is not there. The current act, BAA, says appeals against traditional courts shall be referred to a chief magistrate. Hundreds of them are referred as we sit here today. But there is no mechanism for the magistrate to deal with them in two ways. One, there's nothing in the Magistrate Court Act which says they must deal with them in a particular way. So they receive them and file them. And that's what they do. There's no adequate mechanism to deal with those matters. They receive them and file them. When you want them, they give you the boxes of what they have received. So for the first time, this will basically give you a procedure how magistrates should deal with those matters when they go to them, etc. Two, it will eliminate the issues that relate to selective jurisdiction. Currently, the law says if two blacks, which are defined in terms of origin, are in dispute, the special leader may deal with the dispute. But if two people are in dispute, but in the dispute a third person who says non-African is involved, the special leader cannot deal with it. So if Mr. Ratman borrows me a watch, I go home and I fight with Mr. Jian, the watch gets broken. He goes to court. And the person asks, to whom does the watch belong? Then I say, Mr. Ratman. They say, oh, I don't have jurisdiction. Because it's an aspect of property belonging to another person outside the traditional community, etc. That's how it's defined. Two, it's not even defined in terms of jurisdiction. It says a chief shall punish each and every person over whom he has jurisdiction. But it does not define how does he get jurisdiction. So as a result, a chief, especially in the old Kwandebele, will have jurisdiction over the Ndebele's thing. Other people can come and raise issue of jurisdiction. And in terms of the aim, they may not be successful. Now it changes in terms of community. The issue is if you subscribe that community, you stay in that community, you live in terms of customary law, the court of jurisdiction. And those are fundamental differences than this. That's why if the current systems were all going to be subject to review of some sort of session, not even one matter will stay because they happen outside the current framework altogether, etc. I hear honorable member in terms of the issue of consensual ADR. It's a difficult concept. Now, our argument, my view is that consensual does not happen at the time when the dispute arises. It happens at the time of subscription to a traditional community. The moment a community voluntarily, through the leader, approach the premier to recognize as a traditional community and establish a traditional council, which the law prescribes how it must be established. 40% must be women. It must be audited every 2 years. It must levy fines and what, etc. The moment you approach the community and the Traditional Governance Framework Act is applicable, and all the other things, the regulatory aspects dealt with in terms of other laws are applicable, you cannot raise issue of consent only on one aspect. Because this is system the framework. But as I say, it's how we're seeing it. It may not be so. It may be so that you may have to have consent at the time, etc. And the other aspect we've said that it provides, just like the ordinary court, it provides where people themselves feel that they can deal with the aspects outside the traditional court, etc. They should be allowed that opportunity. We went to understand the system in India. And what compels the people to use the system is not that it's prescribed. It's its benefits. If you want to follow the formal course, you will resolve your matter in 10 years in India. If you follow the ADR and control, you will resolve your matter in 2 months. and people want to go ahead with their lives. Now, that's what we think is compelling reason for people to do this. We don't want to impose to them. We want to market to them. The people must be able to say, look, I've gone to a court where I use my language, where they never use technical legal terms, where I've been to stop my chicken. Then go to a massive court where you lose your neighbor's being sent 3 months to jail and get home and lose nothing. So the people must be encouraged. That's why I say the law must not be simply imposing this system. It should be seen as providing a mechanism to assist them, etc. Hence the issues of consent, whatever, if they're going to be raised. Look, good things must be imposed because those things are good, etc. Not because they're bad. That's our view, etc. But obviously we thought that it would diminish the value of the system and also the effectiveness of the system if we're going to write in law the whole issue of consent. But as I say, we need to be guided by the honourable members how to do those aspects, etc.
May I add to also on the question of the changes that will be brought by this bill if it is adopted? Because as for changes, they will be there, and like JB says, that it will not necessarily change customary law, but things like the oath of office, which traditional leaders used not to do, and a mechanism of dealing with issues of misconduct or incompetency, which is in a way aligned with the provisions in the Framework Act that is administered by the former DPLG, are just some of the things that will change. And also, because there are specific issues that you can pinpoint that this will change from now on. This will have to be dealt with differently, like in the public hearings. Concerns were raised such as the matters of, corporal punishment in the traditional court. And although we know that is outlawed, it is still felt that it is happening out there. But then with this bill, it is specified that may not be happen, or any treatment that is inhumane or cruel. Although the Section 20 of the Black Administration Act also provide outlawed punishment that is inhumane or cruel. And on the issue of opting out, just to demonstrate how that is a difficult concept to deal with, even in the comments that were submitted during the public hearings, there is no clear direction as to what should then be the case, because you find that some commentators saying, should the bill provide for opting out, the system of the traditional system or the traditional leaders would be undermined by their communities. And some commentators are saying, no, it's a good thing. Provide for opting out. So those are just some of the challenges that we met, when dealing with the submissions themselves.
Thank you very much. Do you still have comments, questions? Then, if we don't, we must talk about the process. Do we do it now, sitting as we are, or how do we proceed from it? With some advice. From the old hands in the South. That is. Thanks.
Chairperson, can we afford ourselves an opportunity, a little bit of space to think about and to consult with one another before we proceed any further. That would be my humble request to you and the committee.
What form of the consultation is taking? We stay at the committee, or we bridge into an informal discussion? What we do? That be specific, please.
I thought we could break, and I'm not sure how long the consultation will take. My comrades and colleagues will have to assist me here, and depending on how long they take, then that will determine when you call us back.
Let's just verify. Is that it? That is. Do you know how long that is? Let's reconvene after the session. Gives us enough time to dwell on some of this. There must be reasons why members want to consult and so on. In other words, the department can go for lunch, members of the department. When we convene, we can communicate to ourselves what we do. Yeah. Okay, if that is fine, let's meet that way. Thank you. Yeah, come back at 3 o'clock. As soon as we finish, let's say.